Thank you very much, Simon. Thank you to all four of our speakers, except they've created this huge real-time problem of not having enough time. So what I'm going to try to do as you text in your questions is try to work your questions together to get a bit of progression in the conversation. Can I start, while waiting for your questions, can I start with where we are now and then move on? Where we are now. Craig, does the banking side of data at Suncorp talk to the insurance side of data and come up with a whole of customer view? You're on. That's good.
All right. Very good. Yeah, absolutely. So essentially the data lake is actually across the whole organisation. Because as a general insurance seminar, we didn't sort of talk about some of the banking use cases, but there is definitely the concept of a 360-degree view of the customer and basically making sure that a holistic understanding of the customer is at the centre of the decisions.
Okay. You've been with NAB, working with NAB since 2009. I'm a NAB customer. What have you done for me? Because I see no indication as a customer of a bank that they are using... They know me completely if they only knew it. All of my income is washed through a NAB check account. All of everything I spend comes out of it. And yet NAB gives me the firm indication that they know nothing about me, and any time I want to do anything, I've got to fill out another bloody form that goes for 50 pages. So is NAB dumber than Suncorp, or is Suncorp just pretending and their customers are no better off?
So just a proviso. So talking about the analytical back end, so you can certainly bring together a view. The hardest part is actually executing that through all of your systems, processes and technology. So even from a Suncorp point of view, that is a journey.
So your team's got it, but you're not telling anyone. Fair enough. Okay. Simon, what have you done for NAB that NAB is doing for me? Because I can't see it.
I think this comes back to the challenge of the execution of the business. One of those last slides with the Venn diagram. So if the business is not sort of, you know, in this space where they can execute properly, then everything becomes a real challenge. And the execution has to come from the top. Now, I'm no expert on exactly what NAB's done for their customers.
Nothing.
But I think that challenge exists in any organisation in terms of if you're going to start using your data, then you need to have a drive coming down from the top level for them to start using their data to make data-driven decisions to improve their customer experience.
And I've got to tell you, Woolworths sends me a lot of rubbish offers. But anyway, we'll move along.
Not anymore.
The gap between the theory and what's happening to the customer is what's getting to me every time. Right. To our first two speakers, who does own the data? I mean, the Productivity Commission's got a pretty interesting idea. You're both desperate to get hold of it. You know, Paul wants to make a mozza out of it. Alan wants to change the world with it. But whose do you think it is?
Are you taking this?
No. I can talk about that.
They can't decide who's going to speak first, let alone who owns the data.
I guess from my perspective, I've sort of left it to the government to decide whether I was allowed to use it for them and for the people of, you know, New Zealand or New South Wales or Australia. So I guess everything that we're doing, we feel like it's in the interests of the public to do it. So provided that we're very careful about the personal information, so we don't get, for example, names, addresses and birth dates, then I think that using the data for public good is a fair...
It's a contextual problem, really. So it's a problem based on how the consumer's given that data to the organisation that's collecting it and what rights they've given up as a result of that. And so if you take Facebook and Google, like, we all trade social and search utility for our own PI. So we say to Google, I'm happy for you to use that search that I last did because I get that search for free, and you can then use that data on me, which is I might have searched for a surfboard or a car, and then they can then use that data. But I've traded that. It's a willing trade. So Facebook's the same. I mean, Facebook don't provide a social platform for nothing. And so we're giving up our information, our data, for that trade to get that service or piece of utility back. And the same often goes with many collection statements or privacy collection statements in a lot of the organisations that we all represent. And it's just a matter of how fair that trade is. And so most governments at the moment are challenged by which they say, now, should I overreach into collection analysis and regulate how people collect and analyse data, or should I stay and do what I normally do, which is regulate the use of that data? Because data by itself isn't good or bad. It's just data. It's just how people use it. So at the moment, the PC report has a lot to do with, you know, there's some degree of overreach on regulating how we use the consumer's information. And I'm going there tomorrow to talk about it. But then there's a lot to do with how they're going to go forward and regulate, you know, more openness and productivity that comes off the result of using the data.
Okay, there are a couple of questions from the floor which tie in with that. You know, does privacy legislation need to change, or can you extract enough value within the existing laws? There's also a question that builds into the trust in terms of, you know, trusting who the hell has data, and it builds into the question we had yesterday afternoon about trusting the insurance industry, for that matter, trusting business and the sharing economy. When people are becoming more wary using VPNs for the internet, why should we trust any of you with our data? How does that feed into that ownership and control? Why should I trust you with my data?
I think the real challenge is, you know, why should I trust you with my data? Well, it's because you expect, as a consumer these days, you expect a personalised experience. You absolutely expect it. And you, in fact, walk. If you just said, NAB's not giving me a personalised experience, so I can go out the door. Well, if you're expecting the personalised experience, then I think you have to give over some sort of element of trust to people who are going to make that personalised experience for you.
I think a lot of it's got to do with the variation on by which organisations hold data, or at least look to use it. And so trust is a result of... you need to earn the trust, and a lot of organisations, you know, just intra-company, are challenged by which, you know, they hold the data, they govern the data, even by which they manage it internally. And so the Privacy Commissioner, you know, is challenged in that he wants a more competitive environment, but he wants to do it in a way which is sensitive to what's reasonably expected of the company operating with their consumer. And personalisation is a driver in every boardroom in Australia right now, and it's one in which people are operating in, you know, it's still a bit of the Wild West. There's still people, you know, holding data in their own specific way. There's no trust in between organisations, often even within organisations, and so how it's very hard for us to expect the consumer should trust us, but there needs to be more, I guess, guidelines around infrastructure.
And we've just had a demonstration of a significant proportion of the population not trusting the ABS to run a census. They had a good reason not to, and it turns out. I've got a question. It's a question to me, really. Do you really want NAB to demonstrate to you that they know your income and what you buy? How do you balance customer privacy concerns? I don't want to fill out a form. That's all. I do want them to know, so I don't have to fill out forms. Moving on to the next question, all right, that's where we are, and there's the trust question. In terms of using it, you know, it is analytics and what we're meant to get out of it. From the point of view of actuaries using it, as opposed to being replaced by AI, to what extent does AI take over the game altogether? To what extent does your team end up shrinking? These people are hard to come by. Well, we'll do away with them.
I don't need to worry about it. I'll be gone, I think. So, I do see that, you know, with IBM Watson and things like that, there is the possibility that you can cut out the middlemen, the analysts, the statisticians and actuaries. But it's a pretty complex problem, you know, some of the things that are going on. So I guess it's a question of time.
I think there's no doubt that that these technologies are going to take away the heavy lifting, and it does mean that that the human analyst side of things are going to be increasingly involved in more evaluating kind of activities, so more interesting work, which is great. And I think there's two kind of views around where it goes. Is that does AI get to the point for those that think around the technological singularity, where basically AI becomes all encompassing, so it can actually do everything that a human can do and more at scale and at speed. And in that case, our role is basically to make sure that the machine is plugged in and no one kicks out the cord. On the other side, there's skepticism, that because of the unique way in which we're wired up. That technology is never going to be able to replicate the nuance of the human decision-making process. In that case, and that's the more optimistic one where I sort of lean, is that these technologies will become enablers to make, the human analyst, community actually more able to actually generate some value.
So does it make an actuary's job easier or just another tool along the way? Does it replace the tables?
I think it makes the actuary's job more fun. Because at the end of the day, a lot of the cranking, a lot of the cleaning, all of that kind of stuff that will go away in the next couple of years, that allows for more thinking time around the more creative side, if you like to think of it. So a bit of a paradox that I think that AI will lead to more creativity, more design coming into to the actuarial's job spec.
But do you need to be an actuary then?
No, well, I think that, increasingly, as we talked about, it is a multidisciplinary field. And I think that problem solving, is at the heart of kind of, that's a sustainable skill that is never going to go away. If you can assess a complex problem and understand how to attack it with the knowledge of how data analytics and AI sort of, back into that, I think that's the sweet spot.
I think it was the line, looking for the curious mind becomes more important than
absolutely,
maybe
yeah.
being a high-level mathematician. But
yeah, Kevin Kelly said in the future answers will be cheap, but questions will be valuable, and I think that there's a lot of sense in that.
There's a story which I'll just read out a couple of parts from in the Fairfax Press today. And Simon, I did notice you're working for the Evil Empire at News Corp. Mate, it's not good for you. You will get contaminated. Meanwhile, in the Fairfax Press, part of the story today, insurers are already offering deals whereby consumers can get a cheaper policy if they know they're doing more exercise through a Fitbit or cheaper cover for safer drivers. However, big data is also going to mean more consumers are going to find they are uninsurable. And it quotes the Actuaries Institute report that big data has made insurers so good at spotting risks that it will soon create policy headaches for governments because prices for some highest risk consumers will be unaffordable, which is no surprise to the room and the discussion we've already had. The idea that big data is better, always better for the consumer, is that a myth? For every consumer who gains, is another consumer going to lose if your industry knows more about us?
That's a question of personalisation, really, isn't it? So it's up to... It's a factor of whether how much control you give to the consumer to change that, and I guess positive reporting is an example of that now. But if you give the consumer the ability to change their behaviour to get an outcome, it's very much, I guess, Pavlov's dog in a way. You're giving them an incentive to change their behaviour, and as a result, they can choose... whether they want to pay a higher premium or not. It is definitely one of the things that organisations are moving into, that yield optimisation as a result of personalisation, need to think about.
From a government point of view, Alan, is there, for those wonderful things and the great savings that you put up there, is it all upside?
I was thinking about the question from my own personal perspective, not the government one. So I was off on a tangent thinking about how fast I drive the car and I'm hoping that we don't have the black box. My premium go through the roof.
You already have the black box. It's just not connected yet.
It's a mobile phone.
No, actually, there is a black box. From a government perspective... Yeah, I'm struggling to think about the question, really.
He is so shocked by the idea of losing his licence. It's okay. The autonomous vehicle will be driving for you anyway. You don't get to drive.
Yeah. I guess there is the point that maybe governments won't need to sort of legislate as much if if the private sector is sort of doing it for them by charging for poor behaviour.
And the private sector has done such a good job of vet education and prisons and child welfare, etc., at the moment, that I don't know if that's going to wash, really. We are theoretically out of time. There's a question here we haven't got time to answer. That's asking for success stories around customers' experience as opposed to my whinge, I suspect. There's a question about open source. What's the process for proprietary vendors? I think the person asking that question will have to take it during morning tea. Can I, in the time that we're over already, can I put one last question to you? Does big data and all of the promises that have been made about it, does it really only come to fruition with AI? For all the stuff that is going well now, does it reach maturity with AI? Do you need that to really make it work?
I don't think so. From the work that's been going on in the social sector, there's been some pretty amazing leaps forward. Whether we ever get to AI or not, I think is irrelevant. There's plenty to be done. We've still only just started really with sort of welfare and now housing. There's so much to be done without AI. It's not really necessary.
Okay, I'll squeeze in one last question to Alan. Data sharing. The big four banks won't do it now. Why do you expect everyone would be able to do it? The big four banks all think that they can hang on. So I suppose it's for Paul as well, really. The big four banks think they each have so much data they've got an advantage over the opposition, so they're not jumping in and gaining from sharing data. Won't that silo problem remain?
So from the government perspective, they're starting to talk to each other. So Australia's sort of, with all of the state jurisdictions and federal jurisdiction, there's issues around national data sets of sort of welfare and justice and so forth. But they're starting to talk more, so I think that'll happen. I guess in terms of the banks.
Paul, briefly if you can.
Yeah, I have Westpac and NAB both as shareholders, and Westpac's position is slightly different to NAB's, or slightly different to the other three banks, I guess, just around being a bit closer to how the UK and New Zealand think about it as it relates to open data. The broader question is to what degree they provide access and how they do that, and whether it's via an API or via certain regulatory requirements. And it's still playing out.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are unfortunately out of time, over time. As you can see, this is just the start of a continuing conversation on the issues. For now, though, could you please thank Alan, Paul, Craig and Simon. If you just wait a second, I will give you a bottle of wine as a thank you from the Institute. Before I do that, though, among the many things that Alan Greenfield's been up to at Taylor Fry is thinking up a riddle to put on your coffee cups. Have you noticed, if you've been to the coffee cart? It's a puzzle about an evil king who has 1,000 bottles of wine and one of them's poisonous and he's got 10 lives he can throw away to find out. And how does he do it and still get to have most of his wine left over for the Institute's after party? It was a competition. Ting Chen has won it. Ting, are you here? Could you please come forward? Of course, there is one of those 1,000 bottles of wine here for you. And aside from that, you've got to come up and tell us what the answer to the puzzle is before you get it.
So basically the idea is, given enough time, you can always do it by just testing a bottle on each person, but you don't have the time. So you've got 10 people, they either die or don't die. So there's kind of, each person is a binary outcome, and there's 10 people, so it's 2 to the power of 10. So there's 1,000 and 24 combinations, unique combinations. Basically, it's based on the idea each person can taste up to 512 bottles of wine. But as long as you track which 512 you gave to each of the different person, you can kind of work out what it is. So it's a binary number representation. So if you turn if you label the wine with a number and then turn it into binary, and if there's a one in one of the person, you give it your Latin taste, and then when they die, you can recover the outcome, basically.
They're a hard bunch, actuaries, aren't they? There was absolutely no hesitation dealing with this problem. You deserve your bottle of wine.
I'll allow you next time.
Thank you.